everyone. Welcome to the Rhythm and Muse podcast, the premier arts and entertainment podcast for the Daily Trojan, specially curated for Trojans everywhere. I'm your host, Shrika Ramani, and I am so excited to have our special guest, director Andy Cadiff, join us for this wonderful episode, where we discuss the life and career of some of the most esteemed industry professionals. You may know director Cadiff from his work in the Emmy Award-winning show Home Improvement, starring Tim Allen, the critically acclaimed show Spin City, and Hot in Cleveland, starring the legendary Betty White. If you're a fellow cinema student, however, here at USC, you may know him a little closer home as an incredible professor teaching some of the most enriching direction classes at the School of Cinematic Arts. This segment really aims to create a holistic space that promotes conversation. I learn through Professor Cadiff, and through me learns the entire audience that's listening to this podcast. Hello, Professor Cadiff. Thank you so much for being here. I'm going to get used to calling you Andy, but thank you once again.
It's good to be here. Thank you, Shrika.
Sitting in your class, I have really felt like I'm learning from everything, not just on how you help us learn to direct, but also from the life experiences that you share with us. I wanted to know, what exactly is it about direction that gets your passion burning?
I think from a very small age, I just loved, beginning with theater, just loved how I was moved by what I saw on the stage, on the screen, on my television. And it affected me like nothing else in my life did. And I was just drawn to it from the early days, high school, college. And then as a professional, it was always about the audience, you know, and I was just fascinated by the ability to make an audience feel something, whether it's laughter, sadness, thought provoking, the power you have in this medium to evoke feelings and to evoke thought in your audience. That's really what it's all about for me.
You've graduated from Harvard University, but you didn't always want to enter into direction. I believe you started off wanting to do medicine at one point.
You remember everything, yeah. Well, it wasn't that I wanted to go into medicine and didn't want to go into, you know, the creative arts. It was that when I got to Harvard, I didn't think I was supposed to do anything but go into medicine or law or business, and that theater had been a dream of mine, but it seemed like recreational. Also, I picked a university which then didn't recognize film and television and theater even as academic pursuits. So there were no departments. Everything I did while I was at Harvard that involved theater particularly was all extracurricular, done on my own with other students who had a passion for the theater. So I stumbled into pre-med, and then it went to being an English major when I realized pre-med wasn't going to work. And then eventually finding a couple of professors who were also as avid about the theater as I was. And I created an academic curriculum around the history and literature of the theater arts.
I think us as students were constantly confused about this as well. One day I want to, you know, get into direction. One day I want to get into production. Sometimes I'm like, I want to be a lawyer. So it's really a very weird situation. Take us back to you at Harvard. What exactly do you have one particular show that you put on that really changed your perception about, you know, your dreams and your goals and where you want to head post-graduation?
Well, this is going to sound funny because I think people associate this show as very mainstream and very, you know, not edgy, but it was Oklahoma by Rodgers and Hammerstein. And I was drawn to the original play, Green Grow the Lilacs. And that was a very edgy play. I mean, Oklahoma was actually about abuse and it was about prejudice. I mean, it seems funny to talk about the cowman and the farmer must be friends, but there was a real conflict at the turn of the 20th century where those two factions, as you know, the world was developing, the farmer and the cowhand weren't friends. And there was also a very strong storyline in there where one of the characters tries to rape another character. Now, they softened that, obviously, in the Broadway version. But there still is a couple of songs from the original Broadway version that never made it into the movie, which are dark. I mean, dark. One is called Lonely Room, where the character Judge is sitting in this room talking about his life. So I was really drawn to that. And what I decided to do was to do the show in black and white. Everything was black and white, even though obviously there were live humans. All the clothes, all the sets, everything was black and white. So it looked, had a historical look to it. Also didn't look the way people associate Oklahoma with colors and flowers and all sorts of other, you know, brightness to it. I wanted to have it be dark, except for the Dream Ballet, which would be in color. And I also rewrote the ending, and this leads to a funny story, because I rewrote the ending as I wanted it to be darker and I wanted it to have more resonance and more impact. And I was fortunate enough my senior year of college to meet Stephen Sondheim. Now, I'm not sure I knew at the time, but Oscar Hammerstein, who wrote the book and lyrics for Oklahoma, was Stephen Sondheim's mentor. And Stephen Sondheim is a lyricist and a songwriter. And I kind of, when I met him, was doing Oklahoma and very kind of proudly told him how I had rewritten it. And he just he went ashen. He says, "You can't rewrite this great material." And then I explained to him what I did. And he actually said, "I'm serious, but I'm kidding." He says, I really admire your moxie. And I think what you've done is actually terrific. He said, "But be careful how you muck with writer's work." Mm-hmm. Him being a writer. But that also began a long relationship with him.
I know you did do a bit of stage management for Mr. Harold Prince, who's been a producer for shows like West Side Story, Phantom of the Opera. What exactly was his influence on you, and how exactly did stage direction really influence your direction for television eventually?
So I had very little connection to Broadway growing up. I wasn't like a New York City kid that, would just go to Broadway shows. My first Broadway show was when I was 21 years old, and I went to see Candide, which was coincidentally directed by Hal Prince. And I was really blown away by the show and by the inventiveness of the staging. He really tore a theater apart and just had the show take place all throughout the space that once was a theater. And I wrote him a letter at that time saying I would love to meet him. And long story short, he hired me to be basically a gopher, to work for him for no money, fetching coffee and other things. But, as opposed to going to a graduate school for theater, which was an option, something I thought about, the 3 years I spent with Hal Prince was the best graduate school I could have ever gone to. I went to the graduate school of Harold Prince. And what I just learned so much, I was there with him during the gestation and realization of 4 Broadway shows. And, and this was a lifetime friendship until he passed away 2 years ago. And so it was amazing to watch him and to watch the way he worked with actors, to watch the way he worked with the script. Hal was what I called a room changer. And I've only met 2 of those in my life. And what I mean by that is when he walked into the room, the chemistry in the room changed. You felt it. It was palpable. People stopped. I don't care if there was 5 people in the room or 500. When he walked into the room, everything stopped and all the heads turned. Like the old E.F. Hutton commercial, that's what it felt like. So he was a huge, huge influence on me, and in some ways spoiled me, because I saw what was possible. So I never could settle for anything less than that. I felt like, no, I need to strive for that level of creativity.
Do you feel like you still consistently keep striving for that? Or do you feel like you've achieved a sense of success where you've, achieved that level of creativity, or at least a level of creativity that you would aspire to achieve at this position in your life?
Hal had 25 Tony Awards sitting on his credenza behind his desk. And if you had asked him the same question, he would have said no. And I don't believe as an artist, you can, if you, you can ever say you've achieved that, that you've reached that level, because there's always something that you haven't done. There's always a level you haven't reached. You know, I mean, someone asked Stephen Sondheim once, how do you know when a song is done? And he said, when I walk away. Because if I stayed at the piano, it would never be done. And I feel like, you know, when I was younger, and not much younger, I thought, oh my God, life is not long enough to achieve everything I want to achieve. I only have a limited amount of time to do a limited amount of shows and films, and I'm going to run out of time eventually. So no, you never, ever get to that point. And I don't think you can be complacent as an artist.
There's so much, as you're saying, there's so much room for improvement, but there's also so much room for doubt as well, right? Because if there is no measurable quantity of what success is, then success is entirely dependent on where you see yourself. Did you ever feel like you wanted to set a sort of time limit to what you were achieving, that you had a sort of backup, and the moment, you know, this didn't seem practically viable, you were going to switch away from it, move away from it?
I had a 5-year plan when I graduated college. And I basically was, if I don't win a Tony for best director in 5 years, then I am going to step away and I'm going to either go to business school or work at a studio, you know, and not be a director. But 5 years, that's all I'm going to give it. And if it hasn't happened by then, I'm going to walk away. And the thing that, you know, it didn't happen that way. And but where I was, the thing is, where I was 5 years into it, I was so deep into something creative and wonderful. It was smaller than I would have thought it might have been, because it was an off-Broadway show rather than a Broadway show. But it was still, I was immersed in a fabulous creative process. And so I felt like I was on my way. Now, the other thing, the other benchmark for me, you know, these are all arbitrary. These were my benchmarks. I promised myself that when somebody I trusted came up to me and looked me in the eye and said, you're not good at this. You need to do something else, I might have listened. That never happened. That you know, when I went through a lot of, like, you know, days and even months and years of very little money earned and having to keep going on sort of blind faith, believing that I was on the right course. And, you know, that did carry me for, you know, in the times of doubt, as you say. And it wasn't doubt of my talent. It wasn't even doubt of, it was doubt of if it would happen. You know, and that was really where the doubt came from. I was sort of like, how can it happen? You know, I'm doing all the right things. It hasn't happened. How can it happen? And then all of a sudden it happens. And it happens differently for every person. Their story of how it happened. If you wrote a book, how it happened, and you interviewed 250 artists in film, television, and theater, you'd get 250 stories.
I like how you say how it happened. Can you define what it is for you? Or, like, when did you feel like you had made it? What was the it that had happened?
I had a musical that I was working on, and we had been working on it for a couple of years. And we ended up previewing the musical at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And after about a week of previewing and fixing and doing everything, we were suddenly getting standing ovations. And then the reviews came out and they were great. And our New York producers were like, okay, this is going right from here, off Broadway, we're gonna start to, and everybody was excited. And so the moment was, I was literally standing at a urinal in a bathroom in the theater. And I was literally thinking, oh my God, this is the moment. This is the moment. Everything's going to change.
That's interesting. So I was watching an interview with Sarah Paulson recently, in which she said, the film industry is not a meritocracy. And she openly said that it was not based entirely on creativity, but it had to do immensely with the network that you had and how you built that, because creativity is something that almost everyone has at this point. How true is that statement, and how exactly do you believe that you cracked it, or that people can crack it? Or is there even a truth to that statement in any way?
But you don't have to network. I never networked. I didn't feel like I did. And in retrospect, I was just talking to a mentor of mine actually yesterday about wishing that maybe I had networked more. But I always thought that the talent would out. I used to say, hey, if they want me, they know where I am. They've seen my work. They'll come and get me. I don't have to go out to coffee with them. I don't have to go to their parties. I don't have to, you know, schmooze. I think that, you know, I should have probably done more of that. There maybe would have been more opportunities, more diverse opportunities. But it just wasn't my nature. And look, I always say to young people that come to me, they say, what should I do? I said, the first thing is be around people that are doing it. Be around other people. Don't sit at home and write your screenplays and put them in the mail. Don't, you know, sit around and put yourself on self-tape and, you know, send it out. Get out there, meet other actors, meet other writers.
So can you take us a little bit back to that first, the interaction that you said you had with a writer from Harvard, and which is why you got that first spot. How exactly do you go about convincing a writer, especially who writes something? And I've met way too many writers that hold their writing as their little children, you know, in their hand, and to entrust that in someone else. How exactly did that conversation go about, where you made sure he felt completely trusted in you to handle his little baby?
Well, I'll tell you exactly how that happened, and I hope it doesn't then sound contradictory to everything I've said. But I met him while we were at school. He left after his sophomore year because he was also an actor, and he went on Broadway immediately. He was after sophomore year. He was in Pippin, then in Chorus Line.
Wow!
And then I came to New York, and I started working for Hal Prince. And I think we got together socially or something. But there's no question that my connection with Hal Prince intrigued him. You know, and it's sort of, I think that he sort of felt like maybe by osmosis, you know, he's learning something, or he's got something. But there's no question that that was a factor, because he was in the Broadway world. He was in Chorus Line. Mm-hmm. So he could have shown his work to other potential directors. But I think the fact that I had established myself with Hal Prince, and then him showing me, now I don't know whether he showed me his script just to see what I thought, but I was so passionate about what he had written. And I told him that, and I told him that I can do this, you know, and a lot of it, you know, it was, I think, my confidence and my vision for the show. And, you know, Hal Prince used to say, you know, well, we know, you know how to be an actor, you know how to be a writer. How does someone become a director? And he said, say you're a director. Wherever you go, just say, someone says, what do you do? I said, I'm a director, you know, and, you know, and that was kind of what I had to do. I said, he knew I had directed in college, but you know, they were just college productions, but I said, no, I can do this. And I think that I have found, even in my professional career, walking into a room and and giving confidence to the people that are interviewing you, because they don't know how to do it. They want someone to walk in the room and tell them how it's to do it. And they want someone who's confident that they can do it. And every big job I've ever gotten has been from an interview that I can almost track in my head. I walked in there and I made them feel confident.
Wow.
You know, because that's what they're looking for. They're looking for someone who can convince them and make them believe that they can do it.
I have had an amazing experience with students across campus. At no point have I ever had a moment where I felt like someone else was pushing me down to grow. But this is, of course, my assumption from my experiences. It's not been the same for a lot of other students who've not felt the same way, who felt like they were being targeted because, you know, someone else wanted to grow out of their failure. And it's incredibly sad and it's incredibly concerning. And I just really hope that we as students can come together to make that better. As I mentioned before, you are also a professor here at USC. What exactly has been your most enriching experience being a professor here?
Well, it came out of a lunch with Barnett Kelman, who's a friend who I've known for a long time. And he said, how would you like to teach a course? And it just, you know, and I had always thought about it. I always thought, wouldn't it be fun? Because I knew other directors who were at USC or UCLA, and I knew of Barnett doing it. So I was always curious about it, okay? And then when I did it the first time, you know, it was funny because it was like, I said, so Barnett, I said, what do I do? He goes, whatever you want. Just do what you want. You know, here's the guidelines of the course. Just do what you want. And so I did. And I, you know, just decided that my philosophy and my approach to every course that I would teach would be that the more the students were teaching themselves, the better. I didn't want to lecture. I didn't want to be behind a podium. I didn't want to be, you know, doing PowerPoints. I just wanted to get the students on their feet directing. And you know how terrifying it was the first time, you know, but I wanted that. I wanted them out of their comfort zone as soon as possible. And I meant what I said the other night when we had finally seen the fruits of everybody's labor and two students had shot their scenes. And it was kind of like, and four students had, you know, operated cameras on each of their scenes, and it was kind of awesome. So it's been maybe more fulfilling than I would have thought, because, you know, when you direct for 30, 40 years, you start to direct actors who maybe are a little cynical, or, you know, it's not always fresh, or there are people that feel entitled, and you're dealing with personalities, and the students just want to learn, and they're just excited about learning. And I think that their excitement about learning about something they don't know anything about, you know, I mean, when I'm teaching, I don't teach Betty White, you know what I mean? I'm there to create an environment for Betty White that she feels comfortable in, so she can do what she does. But to have students that admittedly, I've never done this. I don't know what this is. I've never been in a booth. I've never operated a camera. I've never talked to an actor. That's exciting to me. As far as, you know, I'm doing two classes this semester for the first time, which I never thought I'd do. It's a lot. It's a lot. And I love it. You know, and so I actually feel for the first time, because I used to always juggle teaching with directing for real. But with the pandemic, you know, I've stepped away from on-set directing for a while and have more time for teaching. So I feel like a full-time professor now, you know, which is weird. And I like it. I like it because, you know, you asked before something about, you know, do you ever get to that point where you feel like you've achieved everything you can achieve? It's not that I'm at that point, but teaching is definitely an area that I have not tackled, you know, that I have not experienced.
When it comes to people that have achieved high amounts of success, I think we rarely talk about their failures. We talk immensely about their success. And for individuals that are on that journey to success, it's almost a natural that they will face failure in their life. What was that one failure in your life that taught you so much that it helped you grow as an individual?
You know, I had a lot of obviously ups and downs and bumps and bruises along the way. Everybody does, you know. You know, whether they're individual failures over shows that don't work. But the one that was most impactful to me actually occurred as I was rising meteorically. Mm-hmm. I moved to LA, gave up the theater, pursued my contacts here in TV, and got involved with a company that was very, very successful. They actually were doing The Golden Girls with Betty White and B. Arthur, Empty Nest, It's a Living. They had like five shows on the air, this group of producers. And I became sort of the golden boy very, very quickly and rose very quickly in this company to the point mm-hmm. of getting putting together a new show that they had and being the director producer. So it was the first time I was director and producer. And I mistakenly felt entitled. Mm. You know, I thought that that title or those titles gave me the right to, even though I didn't necessarily think I was overstepping my bounds, it was perceived that I was overstepping my bounds. Mm. And there's a lot of sensitivity in the TV world particularly. And I, coming from the theater and where it's more autonomous as a director, and you can kind of say what you feel and get done what you feel needs to get done, there was a frustration with this show. It wasn't working. There were things that were problematic production-wise, writing-wise. And let's just say I opened my mouth and said what I thought. I felt it was for the good of the show. It wasn't self-serving. I was frustrated. And, you know, I just thought someone had to say something. Mm. And as director-producer, I thought, who better? And so we had done about 10 episodes of the show, and the producers called me into their office and said they were letting me go. Mm. And I had literally just had a baby, just bought a house, a very expensive house. Mm-hmm. And not only that, they said to me, you have some serious public relations work to do. And the show was produced by Disney. Mm-hmm. So it was ABC Network, Disney company, and this company. So like the biggest producing company with ABC. And I walked out of that meeting kind of shell-shocked, just shell-shocked. And, you know, I did my due diligence research. And so when the irony was, I had a contact at Home Improvement, an actress mm-hmm. I had worked with. And they were looking for their second director, someone for the second season. And she put my name forward. And they didn't know anything about what had happened. And they said, oh, sounds great. She said, he's a theater director, knows how to talk to actors. So they hired me. They met with me. We talked about theater. And then they hired me for 4 episodes. Suddenly, I got a call, and they brought me back in, and they said, we have to go down to 1 episode. Oof. We hear you're difficult.
Oh, no.
And I said, okay. I said, I'm not difficult. I said, but I hear you. Hmm. And you can be assured that you will not have any problems. It was a very difficult situation that I was in. The irony of the story is the 1 episode that I directed turned into 2, which turned into 4, which turned into the 13 for the whole season. And at the end of the 13, they brought me into their office, the producers, said, we want to hire you for next season. But we have one, you know, constructive criticism or one thing we would like to see from you going forward. And I said, what's that? They said, we need you to be stronger. And I said, you realize how ironic that is? And they said, absolutely, we realize it. So the lesson learned was very powerful. How can I be strong, but be careful and be considerate? It turned into, you know, me directing 4 years on Home Improvement. And obviously that changed my life. Just directing that show changed my career and my life. So that was a pretty hard lesson to learn. And there were times when I didn't know if I was going to be able to recover from that. But I did.
Thank you so much for being with us on this interview. I had a wonderful time talking to you. It is an absolute honor learning from you. Every minute of what you say is just wonderful. Thank you.
Saria, I appreciate it. I enjoyed talking to you. And I will see you in class.
Thank you to all of our listeners. Daily Trojan constantly strives to provide accessibility to our Trojan students, to wonderful industry professionals, conversations that matter, conversations that we can learn from. Thank you so much, and I hope you guys have a wonderful week.